Blog Talk Radio.
So for me, and I'm sure that I cover a lot of generations, so, you know, just like the others, with God's help, we'll see this one as well.
Yes. Well, in terms of the cricket, Derek, we have a situation, certainly, where people would want to play cricket. Jeffrey Dujon was on this show last week, and he was saying, you have to forget it. I know there's talk in relation to cricket West Indies now possibly having that England series. There's talk of it starting July the 8th. What are your thoughts?
Again, the sooner we can get back to as much of normalcy as we can, the better. And obviously, in my case, you're looking forward to cricket. But you don't want it to be an artificial type normalcy. You want to see cricket played. You want spectators there to enjoy it, not just the television audience. You want the players to be able to interact as they do, you know, whether in joy or disappointment. That's all part of the game, so we need to get that back. But having said that, Andrew, we also have to guard against opening doors, relaxing lockdowns, and what's the price that you have to pay for that? Go back into the depths of pandemic again, and more cases, more deaths, more devastation to economies, etc. So if it is that we have to stay away for a little bit longer, it's a small sacrifice in the wider context of things. Mm-hmm. So, yes, while I would love to see cricket as usual in early May in England and the rest of the season, so be it if we have to miss one season for the well-being of the Caribbean and the rest of the world.
Mm. Dr. Ford?
Good night, Derek. Are you having any issues with university students from Trinidad or other of your nationals who would like to go back home but are in Jamaica and still hoping to go back to Trinidad?
Certainly. I mean, the first reaction to anybody who is outside of the country of their birth or their home is, look, we want to get back home. Whatever unnatural situations we find ourselves in, we are going to be more comfortable doing that at home. So certainly the students, I think, were fairly unanimous in January, February. We want to go home. You know, it may have changed for some now, but again, it's a situation we're dealing with. The government has not been able to open the borders to allow all our nationals in Jamaica or the university to go back home. But again, we've provided some relief for the students and in the process of doing that. And I think on the whole, that they too understand the difficulties we all face, and nobody wants to be the one that breaks causes the straw to break the camel's back. So I think on the whole, all while I could say the nationals would like to be back home at this time, I think they're very understanding and very concerned also with the Jamaican environment. So they know that they also have to conform to the restrictions to ensure the safety of everyone.
In Barbados, there were some students who had wished to return but missed the window when the borders closed. And due to unemployment, which is a scourge of most of the countries in the world, were having difficulties, you know, due to their parents becoming furloughed or unemployed and would have needed assistance. Have you had to reach out to any students with care packages or any forms of assistance with accommodation or food things of that sort?
We have this. As I say, the government has started awarding their care packages to some of the students. The university, the campus, certainly at Mona, and I also believe at UTEC and at the other universities, are bending over backwards to accommodate the students who have not been able to go back home, and why most of the Jamaicans have gone to their own homes. You know, the campus is still functioning well enough to maintain services for the international students, and particularly at Trinidad and Tobago, we have over 100 students on the Mona campus. So I'm very grateful for that, and it's a question of all pulling together now and working to ensure that we all come out of this better informed and better suited to cope with any challenges that life has to throw us in the future.
Well, getting back to your local board, I don't know what the financial situation is of your local board, but do you envisage difficulties with programs and just maintaining the same level, you know, workers with the board? Do you think there'll be some attrition and some in Trinidad?
There will have to be, I think, just the sheer economics of the situation. You know, you can't keep going back to the government for care packages, etc. And it's not just the government, it's the corporates, everybody is suffering at this time. So there is going to have to be a lot of belt tightening. There are going to have to be a lot of creative programs to kickstart the economy once we are able to get back to normal living. But it's one of these things that teaches us that you've got to take it one step at a time. So, you know, the priority has to be survival. The priority has to be each person looking after their neighbors, their community, etc., to make sure that we are, you know, physically able to continue thereafter. And then we start thinking outside of the box as to how to derive revenue, how to derive income, how to start back businesses. Some will not be able to start back, but it will provide opportunities for new things, new beginnings, and we have to be prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. Back to you, Andrew.
Well, of course, we want to go down memory lane with you as well. We are very conscious of the time. I know you're a very busy man there in Jamaica. But just before we get there, a couple of current issues. I note with interest that the world governing body of cricket announced that under the supervision of umpires, players will be allowed to use artificial substances to shine the ball to generate swing until COVID-19 is under control. So that's a bit of ball tampering. I mean, do you support that, Derek?
That's going the full circle now from trying to stop it to try to encourage it. I'm not sure that it needs encouraging. You get a ball and you pull it, and if you you use a little bit of the sweat of your brow and nothing else.
Right. Yes, well, these things happen. And before we look at your illustrious career, a couple of other things happening. In fact, Dr. Ford was talking about your own board there in Trinidad and Tobago. But in terms of the job of the head coach, I note with interest that seems to be paying a lot of money, because Mervyn Dillon is interested in that job. Imran Jan is interested. We also know that Samuel Badry, who was a budding TV commentator, he seems to be interested as well. And only a couple of days ago, we learned that Suleiman Ben from Barbados is interested in that job as head coach of Trinidad. So that must be a pretty interesting and big paying job there, His Excellency.
I don't think people look at jobs solely in terms of how well it pays. I'm sure it's not that well paid that, you know, you'd leave whatever you were doing to run and go to be the coach. But it's just the thrill of being able to harness the talents of young people in any sport, and a sport you love, cricket. You know, it's a job that people would love. And I think that's why people are applying. I'm surprised that there were so many people from overseas as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you expect that if it was the test match team or the women's West Indies team. But yes, I'm surprised that they had as many as 18 applicants. But it just shows how many people want to be involved in cricket, and that's good for the game.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And a couple of other issues before we go down memory lane. Right in Jamaica, you know, we had only recently Christopher Gayle making an outburst along with Ronnie Sawan, not much of an outburst, more of a response. And you know Marlon Samuels. I'm sure that you are very much aware of what's been happening. What advice would you have for these young men? And certainly in your day, we wouldn't have, you know, people on social media cussing one another, as we would say, with Gayle saying to Sawan that he was worse than the coronavirus and he's a snake. I mean, that's not the kind of thing that we'd want His Excellency would be.
Not at all. And, you know, if you had to give advice to them, it's, come on, guys, grow up. But in terms of the media, and so I would love to say to the media, let's don't dignify this with the amount of airtime being given to these things. I mean, it's pure foolishness. So let's move on.
Let's move on. And I know it's been making its rounds in Jamaica on all the calling programs. Of course, Gayle is Jamaican. Samuel's Jamaican as well.
Again, I'd prefer not to spend too much time dwelling on it. It's not worth it.
It's not worth it. All right. Now, Derek Lance Murray, born 20th May 1943. Well, a birthday's come up. I know Red Spurrier's birthday is also on May the 20th. Mine is on the 26th.
We do share that, but let me state at the outset, Red was born long before me.
Yes, I spoke to him today, actually. Where did it all start for you, Derek?
I suppose from day one, as a toddler, I always remember myself with a cricket bat or football around. My father, he had also played cricket for Trinidad and Tobago, and his brothers and my wife's brothers, they were all involved in sport at different levels growing up. So, you know, it was inevitable that I would be drawn towards sport. And I'm just thankful that it afforded me the opportunity to get to the very top levels. And I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed that career. And even now, umpteen years later, I'm not going to remind you of how many years since I stopped playing. Mm-hmm. But umpteen years later, people are still remembering that I played, I was involved. It's a fascinating game. In fact, sport on the whole is fascinating, and to be involved in it and to still be in a position to talk about it is a tremendous bonus for me.
Yes, well, of course, Queen's Royal College. And then in terms of selection to the West Indies side, you would have gone on the 1963 tour as a second keeper to David Allen, am I right?
That was my first tour. I'd played couple of times for Trinidad and Tobago before that, so while still at college. And, you know, it was great in those days getting into the senior environment. Players on your own team, players in opposition, were always so caring of the youngsters as we came up. And everybody had an encouraging word. I mean, they would still try to knock your block off when you were batting or keeping wicket. They would try to outsmart you. But they were always so helpful. And I am so grateful for coming in at that time. And particularly in 1963, having the opportunity to be captained by Sir Frank Worrell. I mean,
right.
A supremo in his own right, not just as a cricketer himself or as a captain and tactician, but he was a father figure, mentor to all and sundry And it was just wonderful to learn at his feet so much about and appreciate the history of West Indies cricket. And we were taught to be grateful to all those people who paved the way before us. George Headley, Harry Constantine, you know, the Stallmeyers, the Rays, you go through, I mean, the Freedoms, you know, you know, you just roll through the game. My own first roommate, Simon, you know, people who imparted so much help, encouragement, and knowledge to you as you were coming up. You know, I think I would have been ashamed if I hadn't been able to progress as far as I could with their support.
Indeed. Well, it would have been Sir Frank's last series as captain. And you had a stroke of luck, though, in terms of getting into your first test match, because from memory, Alan fell ill and you got your opportunities. And what an opportunity it was.
Exactly. But, I mean, my whole history of getting into cricket and playing at different levels seems to be just one big stroke of luck. So I'm not complaining, and I still have the odd stroke of luck here and there now. My wife is still with me after 54 years.
Oh, so, wonderful.
You know, that's another stroke of luck.
So, you're doing all you're doing all the right things, Derek. You're keeping well.
Obviously, you that goes without saying.
Wonderful. Just before Dr. Ford comes in, though, I mean, that was a obviously a tremendous series. I mean, when you look at the Oval with Hunt getting 100-plus and the tremendous batting of Kanai.
I mean, the whole series was fantastic. I got into the team and joined the team, and remember, the majority of that team has been part of the 60-61 tour of Australia.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that tour that was added to the reviving test in the world, which, as the world goes through ages where test cricket is going to die, that was one of them. Mm-hmm. And so the team had already been fairly close in this under Frank, and have been gone through that series, the time test, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that every opportunity we had to play one of those five test matches was a very special test match in different ways. In fact, I still look back at the second test at Lord's in that series, which ended officially as a draw, but it was England needing 5 runs to win, West Indies needing 1 wicket when the last ball. I mean, the ups and downs of that test match was so fantastic. To me, there have been bigger victories for the West Indies and bigger tournaments, etc. But that test match stands out for me as probably the greatest, well, certainly the greatest that I've played in. But I think second to the Thai test in 61, that must be the greatest test on record.
Mm-hmm. Doc?
All right. Derek, tell us about the effect that Kerry Packer's World Series cricket had on West Indies cricket.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous, and it was not just West Indies cricket, because we were coming to a stage in the mid-90s. We had were also just talking and just finished the first ever Cricket World Cup, which took the 50 overs format. Well, it was 60 overs in those days. But I think particularly the players were beginning to recognize that cricket was much bigger than it was being made out to be as a second-class sport. People weren't well paid. Mm-hmm. Spectators, you know, were dwindling at times. They were looking for ways to improve it. And many of the people playing saw so many avenues where we could improve and be able to generate more income and therefore generate more income for the players. There could have been more dialogue between the players and administrators because so many of the things we thought that they were doing, bonus points, trying to manipulate different rules within the game to quote-unquote make it more exciting, that we had some of the suggestions that could have gone in. And then Parker came along, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, the people who were going to be running the game were people like Richie Beno, Dennis Lilly, of course, under Parker's ownership and guide, and that he was willing to listen to all the different ideas we have and put it into place, talk about night cricket, to allow people to come in after work, and almost all the things that the players have been talking about the last 2 or 3 years seem to have an avenue. And I think players across the globe were only too anxious to join in, and particularly when Parker constructed the series so that it would be Australia, West Indies would have its own team. And then because of unavailability of certain players and the way courts decided certain things, there wasn't enough to have an England team and a rest of the world team as such, so there was the rest of the world team. But it made us feel as West Indians that we were actually representing the West Indies in one of the biggest series that was going to take place, including most of, if not all of the world's top players. And we just thought, look, guys, this is what we've been talking about for the last 2 or 3 years. We now have an opportunity to actually make this thing work and make it work as a West Indies team. And I am so proud of how the West Indies came together as a team without the umbrella of the board. We had to run things ourselves and discipline and all the things that go with being in charge of your own cricket. And we thought, guys, we're in charge of our own destiny and then, hey, we're going to get paid for it. So that made a tremendous difference to the whole way West Indies players approach the game of cricket thereafter.
Mm-hmm. We spoke to Larry Gomes last week about the Rebel Tour and his final decisions. I know he may not have been involved then, but tell us about, you know, the environment at that time when some of the players were pondering that opportunity of a different sort to go to South Africa mm-hmm. during apartheid.
It was a very interesting period, as you say. Apartheid was very entrenched in South Africa at the time, and there were worldwide moves to ensure that that system should not be allowed to continue. And while initially, should be involved, etc. I think a lot of us then also came to realize how important we were as role models, as figureheads for various causes in the Caribbean, outside of the Caribbean. And I think many of us recognize that, look, we could either let ourselves be used as pawns in the game, or we could actually make statements. And I think for the vast majority of us, it wasn't even a question. You know, we are not going to South Africa. Many of us, some got open checkbooks. For most of us, it didn't even get to the stage of how much or how little you were going to be. We're not going to South Africa. I remember one thing to a senior civil servant in Trinidad, talking about the implications of an offer to South Africa. And I said, listen, I'm not going to kill a man. It doesn't matter how much you offer me or pay me, I say, go and kill this person. The amount of money doesn't arise. I am not going to do that. And so many of us just said, we're not going to South Africa under present circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a big decision for many players, but those that were in and some of those who went, they organized Uber. We have conversations. Remember, some of the guys who went to are our friends. And because you disagree with them, an issue doesn't mean that they stop being your friend or you stop talking to them. So we agreed to disagree. And also, I remember certainly with three or four owners begging them not to go. They had their reasons for going and they went.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. As you move on, of course, in terms of your greatest moment, would have been back in 1975, West Indies versus Pakistan at Edgbaston. West Indies on the brink of defeat, 203-9. But then Andy Roberts, now Sir Andy, and Derek Murray came together. Derek Murray 61 not out, Roberts 24, and brought the bacon home. What an achievement! What a performance!
It was indeed, and it was a great moment. And I suppose throughout history, that's what I'm sort of remembered for. Not a bad thing to remember.
No, not at all.
And but it was absolutely great. And I don't know if I have time to talk you through. There were 16 overs left when Andy came in, 16
right.
overs and two balls.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to talk you through?
Yeah, sure, fine.
Ball,
oh, yes,
ball?
Yes, we're very keen to hear that. Yes.
No, I mean, it was Andy coming in the bat and just thinking, listen, this is no if or but. If we lose this match,
mm-hmm.
we have lost the World Cup. That's the end. So, from that thought, by the time Andy got to the middle,
mm-hmm.
and we had a very, very brief conversation right then, and he said, well, what are we going to do? And I said, listen, the first thing, if you block those next two balls, you have two balls left in the over,
yes.
block those two, and then we'll have another conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the over, we had a little conversation and said, look, this is how we're going to get these runs. There are five runs to get per over,
mm-hmm.
And what we're going to do is look, I'm on strike, we're going to try and get two twos and a single, so I keep this strike most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I said, not a problem if we don't get five every over, but let's just do it. No fours, no sixes, nothing. We just looking. And each over, we watched the field and we said, okay, if you hit it the extra cover there, there's two runs there. If you hit it the square leg, there are two runs there. And then we get the ones and we just talked through the overs all the way through. And then we saw the Pakistanis getting a little more and more agitated
mm-hmm.
From smiling and having fun in the first few overs. They suddenly started, you could see them because they were then speaking in their language.
Mm-hmm.
You could see them sort of say, no, not him. Put him to field there. Don't put him. And then there were five, six, seven captains on the field at the same time. And some of the time, Andy and myself would just say, okay, we got them where we want them. Mm-hmm. Let them keep arguing. And we went along. And I mean, obviously, Andy will have a slightly different story because he will say when he came to the wicket, he took over and things went swimmingly after that. But again, I hope he's not listening because I don't want him to get swell-headed. But if you're getting yourself in a situation where it's dire and you need somebody to be batting or fielding or bowling for your life, you couldn't want a better man. your companion there, so I would think it's Andy, you know, and let the bad guys come and take care of him. But no, it was good and knowing that Andy would resolute right to the end and stay disciplined. So at no stage was there any sort of a strong and get out of trouble. There were even times when I remember Andy played a maiden over, and after this, the third or fourth ball, I could sense that he was thinking, he's letting us down, he's got to score. And just a little signal, say it's okay, two balls to face, knock off the over, you know. It will work out in the end.
Tremendous. And of course, in terms of keeping, you would have had, you know, two different eras. You would have had Hall and Griffith and Robertson Holden. I mean, in terms of pace, who would have been the quickest?
Well, you say that, but I mean, we have always and people talk about Hall and Griffith and forget that Sir Gary Soubers was at times the quickest of the three of them.
Say that again.
If he wanted for two or three overs.
Really?
If the situation demanded it. And once or twice he did actually open the goal in both for Barbados and for West Indies. And usually after doing some damage in the first or second over, he came off and then would let the others. But we would always have someone like that. So Gary was there when it was all Griffith Soubers. Again, the interesting thing about Soubers is that when you talk about the spinners and you talk about Lance Gibbs, you would also talk about Gibson Soubers. Mm-hmm. He was also one of the better spin bowlers that we had. But that's another story for another time. So we had that, and then we had a foursome, which was Van Burn Hoekler, Keith Boyce, Bernard Julian. Not quite as devastating as the famous four who came up afterwards. It was Robert Schoening, Garner, and Croft. But in between that, you had people like William Daniel, young upcoming Malcolm Marshall. So we always had fast bowlers, but there were times when the theory of team selection demanded that you pick two fast bowlers and two spinners. Until I would say round about the mid to late 70s when our thinking. And again, that was partly influenced by our authority that we had over the team in with Kerry Packer's World Series cricket. We said, listen, we need the four best bowlers, whatever they are. We remember when India were the world champions back in about 1970-72, and their bowling attack was Bailey, Chandrasekhar, Prasanna, and Venkatraghavan, you know, who would say that, you know, four spinners would demolish you. But if they were four best bowlers, they did it. But my career was also not just the fast bowlers. It was interesting for me. I kept the fast bowlers almost nonstop throughout the test matches. And then went and played for Trinidad and Tobago. And it was Inchan Ali, Jumadeen, Anand, and Imtiaz Ali. So, you know, people who say that you don't get variety when you're a wicketkeeper, you may get that, but not all in the same day.
But in fact, someone is there WhatsApping me and they're asking, in your view, who would have been the quickest that you kept to?
Michael Holden.
Michael Holden?
Yeah.
Okay, explain.
Well, no, you said the quickest. So he was day in, day out, the fastest of the four fast bowlers. You're doing a little comparison over time between, say, Hall and Griffith at that time and Holding at this time. But I generally measured it by where I had to stand. And I would always find myself standing a pace or two further from Michael than any of the other bowlers. And that was consistently tended to be fairly consistent with his pace. Robert tended to be very much variety. So at times he would bowl not far short of Michael Holding's pace, but more often than not, he was varying his pace, even at that pace, and even at a three-quarter pace, he would still be fairly quick. But he had more variety than many other fast bowlers that I've known. And so there were different types of fast. So it was never boring. It was never just a bowler running up and bowling fast, as far as I was concerned. Andy Roberts had as much subtlety as Lance Gibbs did as a spinner. If you were asking me a different question about who was the best bowler, then you might have a slightly different configuration in terms of Andy Roberts and Wes Hall. Being in this among those that did more with the ball at different times. I think later on in his career, after I had finished playing cricket, you see that Malcolm Marshall did some of that as well. But certainly during the era that I was playing and doing, Michael was the quickest, and probably I would vote for Andy as the best if that is a description.
Talking about Michael Holden, of course, the last test at the Oval, in that same series, Richards 291, Holden 14 wickets. I mean, what a performance!
What a performance indeed, and on a dead wicket that people said, "Oh, that game is going to end as a draw," and we had a meeting. Michael had done very well in the first innings. Ben Stamets had got 200. And I remember saying in the team meeting, guys, this game is going to be drawn. It's going to be long, tedious day in the field for us. And it doesn't matter how dead the wicket is. If you bowl fast, you bowl in fast. And we also had the incentive of Greg's infamous remark about groveling.
Yeah, the grovel series and back in 1976,
Yep, and so the thought of, hey, you could get Greggy out here, was great incentive for the bowler, and none more so than Michael, who I believe he's in the 14 wickets. He got Greg's both innings. And I think he was bowled in both innings.
Oh, dear.
So there were little bypasses in some of these things going on. And Michael was indeed a great competitor.
Doc?
Yeah. Derek, tell us from your perspective behind the stump some of the special abilities of the bowlers you would have kept to during your career.
Well, I think I hinted certainly with Holding and Robert the difference between consistency, the difference between subsistence and variation. Gary Sobers was one of those who kind of cross the two, so he can have some faith, he had certainty, etc. And again, they are always foils for each other, so that, bowling in tandem, Michael and Andy, they would feed off each other. And then they also had the backup of people like Charles Garner, Colin Croft, and they had the Wayne Daniel, who was waiting to take somebody's place if they could. But then you go back to Hall and Griffith, who were two different types of bowlers, but again, complemented each other so much. And in my first series, while I saying here that as a bowler, fairy, etc., you would rate Wes as a better bowler. Charlie, in fact, got 31 wickets during that series,
which was a record
at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unbelievable, his accuracy. So that even when batsmen were more fearing of Wes's reputation,
mm-hmm.
it was Griff who did most of the damage, mm-hmm. both with his bouncers and his yorkers, and who at the end of the series, you know, came to be in the spotlight, the kind of slipped under the radar below. And again, as a wicketkeeper, they were different styles. So again, it was adapting to them in individual games as well as an individual bowling spell. And to me, it has always been fascinating seeing the West Indian bowlers in action and how they brought their strengths to bear on any given situation.
Did you have to play with a lot of injuries, hand injuries, or any significant challenges during your career?
Thank goodness, no. I think I learned to catch the ball properly, so didn't suffer too many finger injuries.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it was it was good, and I kept going. I don't know where I inherited it, but somewhere in the early days, I learned to tape my fingers, so I developed a way with my wife's expert seamstress ability to tape the inners of the gloves, and she made some nice little paddings for me, and though she regretted it at times because I hate having new equipment, so she sometimes had to ban me bringing some of my gloves and inners into the house because I was still sweating from 3 series ago. And But I managed to stay out of trouble.
Derek, who would have been your favorite batsman of all time?
Fist overs?
We should have fist overs.
No, I mean, that is really, really difficult.
Right.
Because each batsman has brought something different to the game. But, I mean, it was wonderful playing your first series. You're playing with Conrad Hunt,
mm-hmm.
Sobers, Kanhai, Warren, Butcher, Solomon. Each one had something different to offer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a question of answering a question. If you had to have someone batting for your life,
mm-hmm.
in a given circumstance, a given situation,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not a question of who's better, who has a better technique, more destructive, etc. Who would do what they have to do for you to succeed, for you to for the team to benefit, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people would say it would be Sobers because of the effect he has on the opposition, and he made it easy for the rest of them around him. But that was his effect on the game, whether he was batting, bowling, or fielding.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you look around the world, I mean, you look at some of the players that we have had, you know, the Kanai, the Kali Charan, the Lawrence Rule, I mean, and obviously Richard. And then we haven't even started talking about Conrad Hunt, Roy Frederick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could go on and go on. And who is the best of them? That's a nice conversation to have.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in this time of COVID, when you have nothing else to do, but remember, you have lots of memories.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I wouldn't like to be a selector trying to pick an 11 right now,
mm-hmm.
even if only from among the West Indians. And we know there are some great players who weren't West Indian, you know, like Sunil Gavaskar, Greg Chappell, Ian Chappell. You know, you just go through the list, Majid Khan, Mm-hmm. You know, you just go through the list of some of the great players who weren't West Indian, and, well, declare my bias. They aren't going to make my number one 11, but they're not bad players.
No?
Yeah. Well, if there was, if you had all the power and you could bestow something on the modern day West Indian teams, what would you want to to give them?
I think an understanding of what it really means to represent the West Indies. I think that is something that would be difficult for people to assimilate without the kind of mentorship that I had, and I'm sure many other youngsters coming into the team around those eras that I played in came. Because I think people talk now in terms of cricket is a job, it's professional, you have to do this, you have to hit 100 balls in practice, you do that. That's not what international cricket is about. International cricket is about having the desire to play a test match, to win a test match, to win a test series. Nothing to do with how much you get paid or how much the coach gets paid or whatever. That's about wanting to do something. And you want to do it, and then you go out and you train. And because you train for 35 minutes today, you recognize that, look, I really could train for 40 minutes and it won't hurt me. And when you do 40 minutes, you think I can do an hour. And then you keep going. And then you recognize that, look, if I'm training to play in a game that you 6 hours a day for 5 days, hang on, how much training do you have to do? Just do a little bit more. Somebody somewhere in the world is doing a little bit more training because they want to beat you. And, you know, I think so much of that is important. So much of it depends, as I say, on coaches, assistant coaches, etc. Sometimes too many cooks spoil the broth. But, you know, you need to get into passion for what it is that you're doing, how you're doing it. You need to believe that there is a meritocracy at work. You need to feel that if you are the best, the coaches will pick you, the selectors will pick you, and you just go out and you're able to do the best that you can, get to the level that you can, and strive to ensure that the team you are playing in, the West Indies team, okay? So again, it's as much about the what we know for in popular jargon, the psychological game, the mental. You need to get into that as much as the actual technique of batting, bowling, and fielding. And that is what makes teams winners. In fact, makes them great teams as opposed to good teams.
Okay, Andrew. Okay.
Okay, well, we want to thank you. My final question to you, I think it's quite an appropriate question as a top keeper. What advice do you have for young keepers in the Caribbean?
Concentrate. And it is the most fun part of the game that there is. Every ball bowled in a cricket match is bowled at you. And therefore, you see everything. You see what's going on. You need to be part of it. And you could be the pivotal part of any team by observing what's going on and being able to influence the players around you of how we can face each situation as it develops ball by ball.
Well, His Excellency, I want to thank you for coming through and talking to us. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you. and enjoy the rest of your evening there in the land of wood and water. And by the way, your Queen's Park people are saying hello to you. There's Ariza Asbali who's saying hello to you. He says he's a secondary school teacher and he's a student of West Indian history. Do you know the guy, Ariza?
I know the gentleman, and he's a walking encyclopedia.
Oh, he is indeed. Oh. Wonderful. All the best. Enjoy the rest of your evening, His Excellency.
Thanks, Andrew.
All right. There you have it. Interesting thoughts coming, of course, from Derek Murray, born May 20, 1943. 62 test matches, highest of 91. And in terms of 50s, he had 1,181 catches and some 8 stumpages. We're going to continue our show. We're trying to make contact with President Ricky Skirk. But in the meantime, let's go and talk to someone that certainly would not have played with Derek, but very much involved in cricket. And we want to say hello to Shakira Selman, the West Indies fast bowler. And she is very much on the air. In fact, we're going to try and reach her as well. We also want to touch base a little bit later on with Clayton Lambert. But are we going to pause for a business call? Well, we're going to do that. And when we come back, we hope to be able to talk to Shakira Selman.
Yeah, I just had to stay home. To be honest, try to stay safe as possible.
Is it frustrating?
Yeah, definitely. I guess that's definitely something that we're always talking about as athletes. So, you know, I'm not complaining too much because we don't get that much time home, but still at the same time, a bit frustrating having to stay in the house so much.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing to keep fit, though? Are you running around in the garden?
Well, we've gotten a fitness program from our trainer at West Indies, which has been really helpful. So he's given us a lot of body weight programs so that we can just use the resources around us, goal setting and stuff like that, in order to get through that program, which has been obviously really helpful for us in this time where we don't have much access to gym or facilities.
Mm-hmm. But this must be very disappointing, though. I mean, of course, it's a situation that we may very well have to be in for quite a long time. That must be tremendous frustration for you, Ailey.
Yeah, for sure. But at the same time, I mean, it's something way around in the whole world. So, you know, we don't have much control over that, obviously, especially in not being able to play cricket, not being able to represent the region. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's a good time to be home, especially after the World Cup. We had getting a good mental space right now, and just waiting on things to calm down a bit before we get back out there.
Just before Doc comes in, a bit of a disappointing World Cup. What were we wrong?
I think over the last 2 World Cups, in 2016, obviously, we won it, and then 2018, we had another good run. But I think this year probably just wasn't our best, if you look at World Cup.
Yeah, I've enjoyed speaking to the former greats over the last few weeks. They gave interesting perspectives on the history of West Indian cricket and some of the, you know, that put us back into that time so we can know what their thought process was and how they felt at achieving all those great things we still look back at nostalgically. And they also have some interesting perspectives on modern day cricket. So it's always an education and it's been great.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, and you know, in that era, he certainly, June 6, 1963, when he went to England. Last test match was in 1980. Yes, and of course, we all know what happened. Some controversy back in 1981 when David Murray took over. That certainly was not the kind of ending that you would have been looking for, but really has been a tremendous servant of West Indies cricket, Doc.
Yeah, definitely. And we can't, you know, that World Cup win, and I guess he, you know, for me starting to become interested in cricket, he was probably the first of the wicketkeepers that could handle himself very well in front of the wicket that I would have seen. And he made a big contribution to our cricket.
Mm-hmm. As we try to make that link, of course, we're trying to see if we can get hold of Kenny Flipper Benjamin. But there's been a lot of talk, Doc, about this series starting on July the 8th. And I heard only this afternoon the sports news done by Paul Mears here in Barbados, Dr. Mansingh, having some doubts about it. But it seems as if people are still keen to have the series West Indies versus England.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being optimistic, but I guess if you are realistic, you would temper those ideas. Today, the ECB was calculating that they could lose up to £380 million due to lack of cricket for the rest of 2020 and some things not going the way that they want. The way that the pandemic is developing in the UK and in other places, and even though we aren't doing badly here, it puts all these things into doubt. And I know that we're looking at methods of having sanitized versions without crowds and maybe, you know, having the players in one location and testing them and testing everyone that's involved in a series. But we'll have to see how things go. But in the final analysis, you know, health trumps everything else. I know that we're in a situation where we'd love to have sports, and we've come to appreciate the importance of sports for the psyche and well-being of, you know, all of us and all of us who love sports. But still, in the long run, we need to look at all the things that are happening around us and do what's necessary. So we're hopeful, but if it doesn't happen, I think we would understand.
All right. We're trying to make that connection. Do we have Kenny Benjamin on the line? Hello, Kenny. How are you? Okay. In fact, we got Raw Lewis instead of Kenny Benjamin. We got the manager of the West Indies side. Hello, Raw. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, Andrew. How are you doing?
How is good old Grenada, the Spice Isle?
No. I think Grenada is fine, but I'm actually in Antigua now.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, you are in Antigua. Are you stuck in Antigua?
Oh. No, I live in Antigua
right.
for the past 10 years.
Indeed. Well, I know that. I was just being cheeky as usual. Are you staying safe?
Yes, very safe. How are you? Everything is good here?
Yeah. So, I mean, I get up early in the morning and do a little jog in the garden and that kind of thing. It's not the same thing, although I went for my nice run. Have you been exercising?
Well, maybe not as much as you, but I've been doing something. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, something to get me off my feet and keep active.
Yeah, I hope, Roy, you haven't put on any weight.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't have a scale at home, but, you know, I don't feel like that. I'm judging from my clothing.
Right. But, of course, you're making constant contact home with Grenada and your family.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a time where everyone has to keep in contact with their loved ones and friends and everyone else, so... You know, we've been doing that. We have a lot of time to do that these days where we are inside most of the time.
Mm-hmm. What message do you have, of course, for West Indian cricketers at this stage? Very serious times.
Well, it's the same message that everyone has in this time. You know, just continue to be safe. As cricketers, we may have to do things a little bit different than the normal individual by keeping physically active. So lots of indoor activities have to take place and, you know, physical activities. But the most important things, as you would know, worldwide is just to save lives, and everyone must be conscious of that and keep safe.
Doc?
Yeah. Hi, Raul. I know that it's a downtime for you, but you've been the manager for a while. You know, we know that your job involves, you know, making sure the players would be where they should be if a cricket was being played. How do you run that fine line between taking care of the players and giving them advice and having the coaching staff and other ancillary staff? How do you separate the roles and as being a manager?
Well, being a manager for me is a very interesting job at this time. As you would know, everything that has to happen, you need to get your medical personnel's advice. So we are mainly focused on being guided by our medical rounded within the management unit. So whatever decisions are going to be made, we have to get medical clearance. So it's not, I'm not really involved holistically as yet. But I'm on the various calls and, you know, getting information and starting to put my information together in case that the tour would come off. But at this present time, we have to get medical clearance before we do anything. So the medical professionals are really on the job more than we are these days.
What are your, being a former player, what are your views on the methods of assessing fitness now compared to when you were an active international player?
Well, I think if I could remember my playing days, I don't think I would have put in enough physical work as I see the guys are doing now. I think the ability to play more cricket, it's much more these days than before. So the medical team and you know, every team has a physio, S&C. So I think more focus is on the fitness side of the players. With the impact of the T20 game also, it's a very fast-paced game, so you need to be much fitter to continue to play for much longer. So, you know, I would encourage them, you know, when I do get with the team to continue the training as I see they're doing. And the guys are very keen. I know that our SNC has been in touch with, you know, not only the members of the ODI or T20 squad, with all the players in the region to monitor their fitness.
Doc, just before you ask another question, I believe we are joined by Kenny Flipper Benjamin as well. Hello, Kenny, how are you?
Oh. Good afternoon to you, Andrew.
Good.
To all your listeners and the viewers, and good afternoon.
Right.
Good evening.
Yeah.
I'm doing okay. I'm locked in and just following protocol.
Right. And of course, staying safe. Getting out early in the morning to do your early morning walk.
Yes, I've stepped up a little bit. I'm up to about 5.5-6 miles in the morning. So I'm doing that. Apart from that, trying to, you know, stay at home, do some planning, have a look at a lot of old videos, and see what I can plan and have what I can have ready, so that if or when this crisis, you know, goes away, then at least I would have had some things in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Doc, you were having a very interesting chat there with the
yeah,
manager. Ron. Continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ron, can you put us there, a fly on the wall, and draw the comparison between a victory versus a defeat for the, you know, in the dressing room?
Well, I tell you what, when you have a winning team, you have a much happier team. Because when you and I talk about the team, I talk about both management and players. So when you are playing well, and especially making the people of the Caribbean happy, you continue to do your work as coaches and support staff, but it's much easier to be consistent when you win it, if you understand what I'm saying. When you are losing, you tend to try different things to get the victory. But if you are winning, you can maintain that pathway through the series if you are doing well and players are confident and the dressing room is nice. You know, all the calls and all the media support and everything is positive about West Indies cricket. It will be much easier than when you're losing. I don't know if that's cleared it up for you, sir.
Mm. No.
Go ahead.
Are you happy with the answer from the manager?
Well, generally, I think I accept that, yes.
Are you sure? You don't sound convinced.
Well, you don't sound convinced.
I'm good.
If you are in the midst of a winning team,
yes,
you could remember the 2016 cricket, the T20 World Cup in 2016.
Right.
Where the West Indies were victorious. You notice the celebrations and the fan support, and, you know, the players were always upbeat. You know, the confidence was there within the group. So, you know, it's always much easier when a team is on tour, especially on a long tour, and you're winning.
Mm. Right. Now, let's talk to Kenny Benjamin. Kenny, you spoke about being very safe and everything. Antiguans are obeying the orders there in Antigua? Are you happy with
the
discipline?
I think it is pretty good. The odd persons you may see walking around without a mask. You know, you're going to have the odd one here or there, but I think most it is for them and for their loved ones. And so I would say a high percentage of the people are obeying the protocols and following.
Mm. And you would say the government has done a pretty good job as well?
Well, that is another story, and you missed.
What do you mean by that, Kenny?
Well, you asked me. If
you're flipping on me, Kenny, and your nickname is Flipper.
No, you're asking me if I was saying that they were doing a good job. Mm. Are you asking me if they're doing a good job? Or
I'm asking Kenny Flipper Benjamin that question. In your view, do you think the government is doing a good job?
I believe, no. I believe more could have been done. I actually believe that we weren't prepared enough. And I just believe that the government and politicians in general, a lot of them, are using this as an opportunity to score some political points. I must say, though, I have listened to your prime minister, and it was today I was on a program with your friend, Denmore Roberts.
Yes.
And we felt that right now we gave her prime minister of the Caribbean. She's very articulated. She sounds really authoritative, and we're really impressed with some of the things that she has said. Well, I'm in Antigua. I don't know what you're thinking.
Oh, yes, she is. I mean, she is. Oh, most definitely.
Definitely is a very impressive. Very impressively.
But Kenny, how do you rate your own prime minister?
I think our prime minister is a little bit too, as a human being, as a leader, I think he's a little bit irresponsible. He makes some comments and responds to certain comments and so forth that a prime minister should just ignore. So I think that maybe a little bit on the immature side, but as a human being, I like Gaston Brown, but as a prime minister, I think he's got a long way to go.
Well, of course, Kenny, you can allow some of those balls to go outside the office. But then, of course, you're not a batsman, you're a bowler.
Well, if it's there to be hit,
hit it. Yes.
Batting is about scoring runs efficiently and effectively.
Well, but don't be surprised tomorrow, Kenny Benjamin, if your comments make primetime news in Antigua on ABS.
Well, the thing about the, what am I going to do? Hide because I give an opinion?
Doc, save me, please.
Well, let's redirect Kenny and ask him about his ability to swing the ball, because I don't think we've seen any West Indian fast bowler swing the ball the way you did since. And what did you know that nobody else knows?
Well, the thing about it is that a couple of weeks ago, we had a meeting, myself, Kurt Lee, Ambrose, Courtney Walsh, and Roddy Estrick. Jimmy Adams was there, and Chris Brazen, I think the coaching manager, and so on. And I think we were looking at what did we find out as we go along in terms of our development. I think they were trying to say, if we can fast forward some of our youngsters, and rather than them finding out, if we can say, look, what is it that you used to do? And so on, that our youngsters need to do. And to be very honest, I believe swing bowling is something I don't know if really and truly something that you can teach. I believe you can tell someone the fundamentals, why the ball swings. But honestly, I don't know why I swung the ball. I don't know why I swung the ball. A lot of the time, I was getting the ball to swing, and Walsh and Ambrose was saying, "Hey, how are you swinging it? I can't get it to even move two degrees, and it's going all over the place." I just think it's just the way you release the ball, maybe just your action, just the pace you bowl. I remember one time speaking to this guy from Australia. What was his name? Used to bowl out swingers. And I asked him, what is it? And he don't know. He just, since he's small, he just got the ball to out swing. You know, he just got the ball to out swing naturally. So it is something that you can know that you understand it, and you look back. You can speak to youngsters. You can speak to the coaches about, this is the best way maybe to hold the ball. This is the way to pull on it and all the stuff. But actually to say, look, I definitely gonna teach you to swing the ball. I don't think I can I don't think that I can do it. I can talk to you about it, and I don't know what I did.
He certainly did a good job. I mean, Carlel Best and company would tell you that you not only swung the ball, but you swung the ball at pace as well. Kenny, a big, strong man there. Let's get back to Raul now. Raul, you know, there's been some talk about the possibility of the tour still going on July the 8th. This is the date I'm hearing, West Indies versus England. As manager, any concerns about that?
Well, concerns, you know, everyone wants to get back to normal life.
Right.
But the only thing that I'm sure that everyone at Cricket West Indies and the ECB will just ensure that the safe, everyone who would be involved on that tour, mm-hmm. if it does come off before anything happens.
Mm.
You must seek government approval. You have to get the health authorities to approve the tour. And, you know, the venues and so must be secure. And, you know, a lot of things that is not going to be as normal as before. So all of these different aspects have to be in place before the tour comes off. So, you know, I'm excited that this cricket is going to start soon, but we have to ensure that everything, all the guidelines are followed so that everyone involved would be healthy and safe to participate.
Well, just before you go, Raul, I know your time is limited. Any advice, you know, in relation to Gail, I mean, Sawan and Samuels? Of course, you've been hearing the rantings. Do you have any advice for them?
Advice for Gail and Sawan?
And Marlon Samuels.
I'm Marlon Samuels. Mm. I will just encourage them in this difficult time to remain healthy,
mm-hmm.
as I encourage everyone to be,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, all their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
But as it relates to the conversations online, I'm not too sure. I have to process it some more, and I think when I meet them in person, I will give my advice personally.
All right. A wonderful answer. Raul, I want to thank you for coming through and talking to us. We're going to pause for our business calls, but we're going to, of course, have Kenny Benjamin on the line. And we also hoped to go up to Atlanta to speak to Clayton Lambert, who every time he saw Kenny Benjamin would hit him all about the park, swing or no swing. Mason and Guest is brought to an association with the very good friends at Barbados Lottery, promoting youth sport and culture.
All right, okay. What have you been indoors all the time, Jeffrey?
Well, pretty much. No, I'm careful when I'm not.
Yes, indeed. Well, so obviously you've had to make a lot of adjustments, Jeffrey. I mean, it's not easy at all. I mean, every morning get up, go for my little jog, you know, around the garden, and then that's it. What have you been doing?
Well, pretty much the same, you know. A lot of stuff you used to do outside, you try to do it inside, and there are some things that you can't do.
Yeah, indeed. Yes, that's true. And your country, you're having some struggles as well, but let's hope that things improve there in Jamaica. Jeffrey?
Well, I really hope so. This thing really seriously, and, you know, try to follow the protocols, and hope that the government finds a way to eventually get on top of this thing. But right now, I think the most we can do is do our bit. And
years I played the 26 test matches and played one day. I enjoy every moment of it. No regrets in terms of the good times that I had and so forth, you know. So I just look at it as an opportunity, and I was thankful that I was able to represent the region.
Now, gentlemen, let me start with you, Clayton. What advice do you have for young cricketers? I mean, we are really struggling. Everybody knows that. Of course, we were very strong for quite a long period. What advice do you have, Clayton, in order to try and get our cricket strong again?
Well, I think we play pretty good T20 cricket as it is right now. I guess you're talking about the longer form of the game.
Yes, cricket, yeah.
The thing is, what you guys have got to realize is that if you look at Desi, Viv, Clive Lloyd, Khalid Duran, Fredericks, and Gordon Greenidge, with Marshall, we can go down the list, right? Those guys played a lot of four-day cricket in England. I don't know if it's like 21 games every year. And it's only now that in the West Indies, I don't know exactly how many, but I think it's home and away, so it's probably 10 games. Mm-hmm. And it's application. You know, sometimes people go out there and they try to bat runs, you know, but the four-day game is more a time game. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're not successful batting runs, I mean, like Lara batted runs, but he was a great and he backed himself and he know when he come out there, he's coming to score.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we are not born with those skill sets. So they probably have to go out there and try to bat rather than just score.
Kenny?
I'm not going to disappoint you, and I'm going to be a little bit controversial, as you call it. I don't think it is the advice you'd give youngsters. I don't think it is down to the youngsters. It has to be everybody, including the journalists, including the Cricket West Indies, our coaches education program. These things have to catch up with the rest of the world. I think we're behind in science and technology.
Mm-hmm.
What I know for a fact with the players, listening to those comments you spoke about early on, we have a problem in terms of commitment, in terms of loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out very clearly. And so it is up to us as coaches, as mentors, as teachers, as parents. We have to let these youngsters, even before they get into the national youth teams and so on, and loyalty. We cannot just believe we want to make some money from cricket and we're not loyal to anyone or to any particular thing. And I think the mentality and the thinking, you understand, shows me why we are struggling. And I believe it is holistic. When we were playing back then, it seems to me like there was a very good knit in terms of the players. A guy said something, you deal with it, you tell him off, and you move on. It was more of the fight between the territorial boards. Everybody want their own players. No cricket person is trying, and I say trying, to become a professional organization.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like it is the players now where there is a separation. It seems to me like it's dog eat dog. Every man for himself. Everybody thinking in their own space. You know, and I think that is the challenge for us, and we need to fix that. And we need to fix that at a very early age. Because once you go into the international level with that kind of mentality, that type of mindset, it's not going to create some problems.
Kenny, Ricky Skerrick just finished 1 year in office. If you had to see Ricky Skerrick tomorrow, in terms of trying to improve West Indies cricket and give him advice, what would you say to the president?
Well, just like what I've been saying there, we need to make the regional franchise fully professional.
Right.
They need to function that way, fully professional, and not just a regional level. They need to look at youth development, coaching education. All of these things have to be in place and have to be working as a well-oiled machinery. What we're seeing at the international level is just the fruits that we're bearing.
Mm.
So we really and truly have to start to get the franchises functioning properly, making sure that when these guys would have reached all the 19s, you know, the whole mindset and the whole training, the mental aspect and everything would have been ready to move on to that next level. So to say one thing to Ricky Skerrick, I think we will have to sit down and talk for a day.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, he comes to Antigua very often. Clayton, we got another, 5 minutes or so on the show. You certainly had a very interesting, very, very interesting career. And if we just quickly go down memory lane with you, you had some pretty quick bowlers, Kenny Benjamin, who knocked your head off in Anguilla. Who would have been the fastest that you faced in your time, Clayton?
I don't know. I know the fastest two balls I probably faced, one at the Antigua Recreation from Ambrose.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got finished in the England, we went to Holland.
Right.
On we played in a Martin, and there was a guy there called Van Trust.
Yes.
Adrian Van Trust.
He bowled me a ball that hit the side screen.
What?
And that wicket was flying, and that guy had some pace.
Oh yeah.
Right. And Those are probably two balls that I remember really well. But if I can get back on Kenny's point, I thoroughly support his point on technology. I don't know what's going on in the West Indies, but I know England is very advanced with technology. And since I came to the U.S., I've been learning a bit about baseball. And I've always tried to tailor my coaching on baseball, because baseballers are really accountable for every misfield, every drop catch, you know. And they are very versed with technology. Mm-hmm. And I do believe it will play a prominent role in sports here on in.
No?
Yeah, well, I mean, getting back to Kenny, Kenny, what contribution would you like to make to West Indies cricket? And secondly, do you think the franchise system has proven to be superior to the older territorial setup that we have?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me answer the first one first. I believe that that cricket West Indies needs a fast bowling unit.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there are some islands that definitely used to produce some great fast bowlers, and I think it is one area that we need to pay attention to. That was our strength some years ago, and it can be again. We still have a lot of talented athletes. So I would really like to be a part of a fast bowling unit for the West Indies. Whether it's stationed, doesn't matter where it is stationed, but definitely to look at the whole structure of getting our bowlers to bowl faster, to making sure that the mechanics and so forth, and they're injury free and so forth, obviously working with the medical and the people with the various skills in terms of technology and so forth. That is really and truly something that I would like. But in terms of the franchise, I know the idea was a very good one.
Mm-hmm.
What probably isn't good, Doc, is the execution. I don't think that there's any accountability from the franchises. We're not seeing a lot of money is being pumped into the franchise by Cricket West Indies, and we're not seeing the results. So obviously, it is not as effective as they should be. But I believe it was the way to go, making more players, you know, being able to play cricket and make a living out of it. I think we need to increase the numbers even more, so that the competition can get, but we need quality. And that is where I'm disappointed, that you have the franchise, but seems to me like the franchise are not responsible for youth development and female development. And so it has to be a comprehensive package. It cannot be that you have Barbados Cricket Association, and then you have the Barbados Trident, which is a that is not going to work. We need one body to deal with the complete development of cricket in every territory.
Interesting. So is a franchise a year-round thing, or is it seasonal?
Well, it seems to me like the franchise is a year-round thing, but the way it functions, I'm not impressed that it is, because what happens is that the guys get a year contract, and the season will start, July, and they would probably start the Super 50 later down, about, say, September, October, and then you roll over into the competition. But my thing is that it shouldn't have to be year-round or what. It should just be the responsible for cricket. So it wouldn't have to be a year-round thing, because when there is no senior cricket, you're looking after the youth development and the females and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is my thing, is that it is just that the seniors, they have a contract running from X to Y, but what about the others?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like the franchise is only responsible for men's cricket.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my problem, Doc.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kenny, this is something that we certainly will want to continue. It really was a pleasure having you on the show. And, of course, the last word is going to be for our friend, who I don't think he's deserted us. He's in Atlanta and maybe plans to come back home when they decide on the president in Guyana. You may very well become the Minister of Sports there, Clayton. It's quite possible.
I'm not sure about that.
No.
I'll come and campaign for you, Clayton.
Yeah, yeah. Finally, Clayton, what message would you want to leave with all West Indians? You're all the way in Atlanta. You've been there now for, what, he says, since 1999. What is your final message for all West Indians?
I was in Guyana recently, and what I've noticed, the infrastructure, grassroots infrastructure, is severely depleted. You know, fields that we used to play on, you know, you could just grab a ball and go there and play and, you know, start developing the joy for cricket. A lot of those fields are no longer there and not as well kept, you know. And I don't know if it's the same around the Caribbean, but certainly in Guyana, that is an issue. And, you know, when we're trying to develop cricket in the West Indies, like so things like that, that used to help to develop, you know, fellow players like Kanai and Butcher and Solomon, I'm sure, you know, they were playing on pastures from time to time. Those fields are no longer there. So that's something they can probably put some money into.
Right.
Well, cricket.
Right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. What we're going to do, we promise to have a part two with you because there's so much more that we have to talk to you about. You've done a wonderful job for Dan, of course, for the West Indies. And Kenny Benjamin continuing to create a big stir there in this country. They call him Kenny Flipper Benjamin, the most controversial man in Antigua. I'm told, Kenny, it's always good to have you on Mason and Getz.
Gentlemen, you continue to stay safe and be well, you and your family.
All right, good. So there you have it, Kenny Flipper Benjamin at the end, and of course, Clayton Lambert. Early, we heard from Derek Murray. In fact, certainly done a wonderful job in going down memory lane. He's now the High Commissioner there for Trinidad and Tobago there in Jamaica. And it was really great to hear from Raul Lewis as well. We didn't get President Ricky Skerrett. We're having one or two challenges in relation to the phone. It's not his fault by any stretch of the imagination, but we hope to solve that problem sometime very soon. Thanks to Dr. Ford. I'm Andrew Mason. He's open for a bye tomorrow.
What he spoke about for Rakim Cornwall was going off two faces, yeah? That is one of Rakim's strengths. No rhythm, he found the batsman, he gets to his balls quickly. So the fact that Lanskid was concerned about it, it just goes to show you how far out of the game Lanskid is. Lanskid is 35 years old. I don't think he's in tune with what is going on in modern day cricket. And he went away thinking that he was onto something. But for me, he scored not.